greet you tonight in the name of Jesus, our Comforter, the one that Lowell has introduced us to, and of course we know him from our own experiences and reading. I was asked to speak tonight, and I would like to include you at times on ministering to those experiencing grief. I hope that after we're done, we as participants will have picked up a few basic skills in caring for people who are grieving. Maybe it will help us also to understand how we process some of these things from time to time. To grieve is to be in great anguish, or to cause others to be sorrowful, or maybe it's events that cause people to be sorrowful or be in distress, a deep mental anguish. Now, I'd like to cover an outline here that comes from the Stephen Ministry in large part, ministering to those experiencing grief, and there are four important preliminary considerations here that we see, and this outline is what's on the papers that are in the center aisles if you've passed them by down. And if there are a few, I put six in each, or I've tried to put six in each bench. So you might discover now to get a few of the blanks, but you also find as I go through. But noticing the first section, the preliminary considerations, and then the second section, three phases of grief. So we will look at those things. Grieving is natural. Not grieving is unnatural. Grieving is Christian. And let's focus on the griever's frame of reference and then three phases of grief. Probably do, yes. Well, probably don't right now. Help me get it back and forth. I want to kind of keep moving here. Imagine with me that it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you are enjoying a good night's sleep when the phone rings and the person calling asks you to go out to the hospital because a family has had a serious medical emergency. And so they're asking that you come and sit with the spouse in the emergency room or in the waiting room. And of course, you agree, and yet you don't quite know what you expect, and you don't know for sure what to say. How can you be prepared for something like that? Will you be finding that the person is alive or dead, and so on and so forth? But you quickly put on your clothes and get in the vehicle and go out. That's the kind of thing that we may face sometimes. Maybe some of you are praying that you never will. But you know, it's fairly likely that one way or the other we'll face it in our families or with a neighbor or a brother or sister in the church. So it's good for us, I think, healthy for us, to be thinking about these things. First of all, grieving is natural. That's the first of these preliminary considerations. You know, a lot of people, I think maybe a lot of Americans, think that grief is unnatural and should be avoided at all costs. And so maybe it's because we feel anxious around people that are grieving. Or when we see someone crying, our first reaction is to try to get them to stop crying or to try to cheer them up. And yet, is that really right? If we have, if we understand, at least maturely as adults, I know that for children a lot of times, they really just need some comfort. And maybe the hug followed by a sweet or something is really all it takes to turn their life around again. But even learning from that, that's the kind of response that people in emotional distress need, is the presence and the hug. So if a grieving person is expressing strong feelings, If we think that grief is unnatural, then we'll try to change the subject or avoid talking about the person that's died. And maybe we ought to stop and ask ourselves, why are we acting this way? Is it that we have picked up from society some things that aren't quite right? We aren't really thinking. Maybe we're just, well, we don't like to think about it. But I think if we come to the conclusion and the confession that grief is natural, then we're going to be more accepting of others who are going through grief. It's the process a person goes through as he or she adjusts emotionally and socially to life without a significant loved one. We don't need to feel uncomfortable with grief in ourselves or in others. Instead of shunning or avoiding grieving people, we need to accept them empathizingly and emphasizingly care for them. On the contrary, to not grieve is the unnatural response. For somebody to just deny his feelings in a prolonged kind of way and stuff them inside causes problems that are going to have to be worked out and worked through over time. So not grieving is the unnatural part. But grieving is Christian. It's a Christian's response. When Christians witness sadness after a loss, it doesn't mean that they, or when we notice it in Christians, in other people, it doesn't mean that they have a weak faith or that they aren't in connection with God. Let me think with me here about what Lowell just read for us. Let's see. It's not going on because I haven't turned this one off. Lowell read lots more verses than I'm pulling out of here, but it's John 11, 20 to 22. Can you read it back there, Josh? Good, at least you can. I can't say that everybody can, but hopefully most of you can. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him. We read that, and Mary also came. And Martha asked Jesus a question, and Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die." So he stopped to give a statement about salvation. Words that are precious to us, we often look to them for anchor for our faith. And then Mary objects, and both of these ladies are just angry about the death of their, I think angry. They're certainly asking questions, and they're grieving. And Jesus saw Mary's weeping and the Jews who'd come, and then he wept. There is something godly about identifying with others in their emotions, to allow our own emotions to come out. And Paul said it, that we should weep with those that weep. Jesus exemplifies it. He grieved the death of Lazarus. Now, there are many things about the story that are amazing. Some things that we probably don't want to do, like wait 4 days when we get that message to go see somebody that's sick, or to go to the hospital when somebody calls for us. I mean, it just doesn't really quite fit, does it? But Jesus was God, and he was planning a resurrection, and he was going to stretch people's faith, and he had a whole bigger picture and ministry than what we do, even though we're partakers in ministry with him, and we can learn some things. But there are some things that go any time as we're dealing with issues of life and death, like salvation and identifying with people. And the Jews said, "See how he loved him." So Jesus grieved the death of Lazarus, and I take him to be a good example in that. When I said something about both Mary and Martha being angry, there are words like, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Don't those sound very similar to the words that we sometimes may say, God, how could you let this happen to me? And then we've noticed how Jesus responded, first in some teaching and then in his identification emotionally. I think that's why Paul says it again in 1 Thessalonians 4:13. I love this verse about grieving. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others who have no hope. So it's in the middle of Paul's writing about the glorious return of Christ and the fact that believers will ascend to meet him. And so we grieve, yes. And grieving is natural, and being with people in their grief is Christian. But we don't grieve without hope. And, you know, I was going to say that I've been reading books and shorter articles, and I want to make a few references here that are good. My father evidently was at the bottom of this topic. He had ordered one of these pocket sermon booklets from Beside the Still Waters by Titus Hofer, and it's excellent. I got the hold of this yesterday, and I read through this, and it's easy to read. It's a tremendous sermon. I would probably say a few things a little different, and I would even disagree with one point, although it's not germane. It's not a major point. But it's an excellent writing about ministering to the grieving. And then Henry Schrock gave me The View from a Hearse, and one of my favorite authors in my youth was Joseph Bailey, or Joe Bailey. He would write editorials in the Eternity magazine when I was a subscriber in my young married days, and loved to write his parables and his stories. And then, lo and behold, the college asked him to be the commencement speaker at my graduation. I was so happy about that. This one comes out of his own experiences because three of his sons died young. So he wrote the book, The View from a Hearse. And the reason I thought of it just now is that the day after his one son died of leukemia, he went to the doctor's office to express to him his thanks that he worked with them for all he did for them, even though there was no way for them to save the son in this life. And as he got there, the secretary, who of course by now would recognize him, or the receptionist, said to him that this little boy playing here has the same condition that your son did. And so he sat down beside the woman that he observed to be the mother. And they got to chatting a bit. I don't remember exactly what all was said, but I do remember this, that Joseph said something about the wonder, the blessing it is to know that a child will be safe on the other side. And this mother didn't have that faith. And so she said, oh, my, I wouldn't know that. I think that a person dies just like an animal. And then as he explained a little more, then she queried back to him. And he had a chance there to give his testimony to her, and God only knows whether that person ever came to this kind of a faith. But I had to say that. And Sunday, last Sunday, I quoted from David Bogard's book, Valleys and Vistas, and I might again tonight. But you know, the night is going. Maybe we won't get everything said that we think we might do. And I might also say that I did some searching. I found articles like Supporting a Grieving Mother and What Can You Do? And here's some poetry by one mother based on some of the practical experiences and the advice. And here's a writing, First Steps in Ministering to the Grieving. And here's 5 Do's and Don'ts for Ministry with Grieving Teens. And another one here, ministering to those who have lost someone they love. And I had saved another time that many at least, and I just brought a few. I thought I might quote a little bit here or there if something just comes flashing back as I go through this outline. The last point of this preliminary section is focus on the griever's frame of reference. To effectively care for grieving persons, we need to strive constantly to view things as they view them. Various factors can make this difficult. You know, I'm just going to make a little aside. This afternoon I was in my office and somebody sat there and he had a reason to come. We did his business or somewhere in the... He observed that I think you've had some problems with your coughing. And I said, yes, I had it in my bronchioles for the first time in a number of years and it was pretty bad. And I'm coming up and out of it, and I'm so thankful to be coming that direction. And you know what he did? He did like I do so often. He started telling me about how he's been working on some sort of a cough or something that's been hanging on for about 3 weeks after he had the flu. And you know how quickly you just kind of go from one to the other? But the point that I think all of us need to really work on in something as serious as grief is that we are careful how quickly we say something that this makes me think of that we've experienced. Now, obviously, we probably can earn the opportunity to say some of those things meaningfully as a way to identify, but to quickly plunge into that without having earned that, I find to be a weakness that I think is somewhat common to man, certainly is one that I need to learn to put to practice. For example, if I've recently lost a loved one and haven't fully worked through my own grief, I may find it difficult to care for somebody who's now in a new grief because I'm still processing. So that's another angle on this kind of thing. Now, of course, as I said, having been through a similar loss can certainly give us greater understanding. But even then, let's stay focused on what the other person is feeling. We can also lose focus by projecting how we think the grieving person should feel. For example, suppose I'm caring for a man who has lost his wife of 60 years. From my frame of reference, I might say, wow, he's blessed. He got to live with her for 60 years. But you know, that's probably not what he's thinking. What he's feeling is he's just lost his wife, the one he walked those 60 years with. And he's feeling sad and lonely. Terribly lonely. And when he wakes up every morning, he may be reliving the immediate loss over and over again. That's his frame of reference. So I beg you, let us focus on the griever's frame of reference and try to see and feel things from their perspective. Now, I want to beg that we go right on in to these three phases of grief. Well, that's not quite right. I would like to pause. We've had introduction. I've primed the pump. Maybe I've said something that you'd like to add to or illustrate, I will give you the time. See, I don't come to you as one who's experienced in all aspects of this. I come to you as one who's experienced some grief. But I can't do it all myself. I can research. I can think to the times that I've shared in other people's grief, but maybe you can fill it out from your personal experience. What would you say, for example? Do you dare say, do you want to say, what are some of the things you've grieved over? I think some life changes, life impacting things we might have grieved over would even be the death of a pet when we were young, huh? But some more. What are the things that you grieve over? I've pretty much been angling in one way, but there are several ways that people can grieve, and grieve very seriously. I mean, over different causes. Okay, I've already hinted at I'm not doing a good job. You're wanting me to just keep motoring, right? I'm not sure. I can wait, too. I've talked about, yes, did I hear somebody? I talked about the loss of a son or daughter. I've talked about the loss of a spouse. We can add the loss of a sister or brother, an aunt, grandpa, grandma. In the scheme of things, some of these probably are sobering, instructive, and good. But it doesn't take so much to recover from some of them. Some of them are almost celebrations of a life well lived. But then some of them are so much more tearing, because they disrupt the pattern. And at the top of the list, aren't they? When a young person dies and when a spouse passes. But there are other things. How about divorce? How about grieving over a child that strays away from God and the church and the family? Packs up and goes, joins a cult. Those things are tough. Or maybe we grieve over health conditions and handicaps. We contend with them. We live with them. Well, the three phases of grief that I'm going to just move right into are shock, recoil, and rebuilding. I think I'll just start right in with shock. And, you know, as we may talk about these things as phases, and yet in reality they aren't always just this one and then followed by that one and then the third one. But you remember how it was that last Sunday I read to you from David Bogard's experience when he found his wife dead on the floor, and he just coolly and calm and collected helped get the emergency personnel there and did his own checking and so on and so forth. And it was just a marvel of God's grace. I remember the time when a neighbor experienced the death of her husband. And I remember marveling how she stood up and seemed to be able to comfort the comforters. And then I also remember that was a phase that was followed by tougher times, as far as that's concerned. And it's not surprising. So shock can have different, in shock we can find that we're dazed or confused or bewildered, seeming preoccupied or surreal, and so on. And in this first section here, what's a grieving person likely to experience during shock? Well, he's probably going to experience disbelief or denial. Denial. It can't be. I can't believe it that he's gone. Really? Can he be gone? And so we try to figure it out. We wrestle. We react. No, she can't be dead. You must be mistaken. I can't believe it. It's an immediate way of dealing with the painful reality. We know the loss is real on one level, but on another level, we just want to deny it. We just, you know, like one person said, my head knew, but my heart denied it. Well, now, denial can be a blessing. It's like an emotional anesthesia that blocks a lot of the deep pain until we're more prepared to handle the loss. It's also why some people seem so calm and composed at the funeral of a loved one. You know, it's possible that they're experiencing shock and denial, and I read one source that suggested that at the end of that story of Job in chapters 1 and 2, when he said that beautiful quotable quote, "The Lord gave, the Lord hath taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord," do you think this writer thought that maybe Job was also being buoyed up in this time of shock? And it's fitting to say it. I don't want to demean it. I don't want, you know, it's just things that we work through as humans as we're trying to figure out how things are and whatever. So maybe that's what it was. I don't know. Now, secondly, it's physical symptoms. We won't recognize that there are physical things that can happen. There's like, it's like breathing heavily or sighing or have uncontrollable shaking or even just getting up and pacing around the room. And sometimes, though, somebody is just kind of frozen into a position, just immobile. Everyone's different. Another physical symptom is what we call the fog of grief, like Kenneth Hogue wrote in his book on Journeying Through Grief, Book 1, A Time to Grieve. He said, "Our grief gets so heavy that it surrounds us, clouds our minds, and interferes with our ability to think clearly. So it's hard to concentrate." Now, how can you minister effectively or more effectively if you know some of these things? Well, what do you think? What have you learned that works? Well, you've got the outline there. The first thing, be present. Another one of these writers said, go. You know, sometimes maybe somebody actually asks you to come, but to go. And I've seen some of you do that kind of thing. It's amazing to see the room fill up as there's been the tragedy that's taken a life. One of the best ways to help is to be there. We can call this the ministry of presence. You show the person that you care just by being there. He might not be ready to talk about his loss, but the wound is still too raw. My wife said, I don't know in which phase this happened, but she picked up and read in this book by Joe Bailey, and she said that the one chapter, there was a grieving man and somebody else came and talked the surface things, well, talked about God, she said. Probably pretty good stuff, huh? But it just was enough that the grieving man wished he'd go. And then he went. And then another man came, very shortly thereafter, I believe, and he sat and just was there with his presence. And that man, he didn't want to see go because he was there. He could sense that he wasn't just motoring to be heard. Now, the second point here, accept the grieving person. You know, we sometimes try to fix them. We sometimes sometimes we just don't find it easy to accept what they're saying. For example, let's say they're in the stage of denial. So how do we accept them? Well, by not challenging the denial. So if the care receiver says, "I can't believe she's dead," let's not say, "You'll get used to it. It just takes time to get over it." But do say something like this, "It doesn't seem possible." So there you are, accepting, rephrasing, reflecting back to the person. Or the care receiver says, "He can't be dead. He just can't. I know I'm going to turn around and find him here." So we don't say, "But you just got to accept that," right? We just say, "I'm so sorry," or identify with the person. Sure, they may be in denial. Sure, we might be able to just diagnose the thing, But again, it's being there, it's accepting, it's weeping with those that weep, it's just kind of sharing where they are. It's understanding them. It's accepting the denial. And if that's what this person still needs to do to hang on to his denial and this his point of grieving, then let's just not try to fix it. And let's listen. You know, a powerful way that you can care is by listening. And one of the best ways to show that you're listening is by reflecting the thoughts and feelings. So when a grieving person shares a feeling or an emotion, in an affirming way, we can reflect it back in other words, or paraphrase it. So it'll look something like this. So somebody is mourning and he says, "I can't bear the thought of Fred being gone." The caregiver says, "It's difficult to even imagine it." And then the next comment, "How can I go on without him?" Well, the possibility just seems overwhelming to you, doesn't it? And so it's just reflecting it back. It's accepting what's there and not trying to say, well, it's, you know, remember this scripture even, probably. I don't want to just say no scripture, but you understand what I'm saying. In the discussion, the consideration of ministering to people that grieve, let's learn to reflect their feelings. Now, I have to admit, in observing my wife for these decades, I think she does quite well at identifying with people's feelings in ways like this. And then, and remember, this is said to illustrate and to demonstrate that we're really listening, is to reflect their feelings back to them and to restate and so on. And then express our own grief as it is appropriate. You know, Jesus wept. We can also weep. But there are some things that we want to be careful about. Maybe sometimes the most caring thing is to keep your feelings in check. For example, we don't want to overdo it so that the care receiver seems to think or feel the need to come back to give us the caring and the comfort. And so there may be times when the grieving person needs you to be the strong one while she is shedding or he is shedding the tears. So use good judgment as to when and how much to express your own grief. It may depend on your circumstances, your relationship with the grieving person, and or the relationship you had with the one that died. So that's the section on shock and some of the symptoms of shock and how some of the steps and things that we can do as we minister to people in shock. It's phase two. But again, probably this isn't going to be a neat one day it's shock, next day it's recoil, but phase two is recoil. Eventually, shock and denial give way for the grieving person, and the reality of the loss really sets in. And it usually happens after the relatives have all left or the out-of-town relatives have all gone home, after the church friends have stopped visiting, and the phone calls are all tapering off, and the flowers have all wilted now, and now we're working it alone. Seems like everyone else is going back to life as normal. But to the grieving person, the painful reality is just sinking in that life will never be the same. That's when the recoil hits. This is also where true comforters are at their best. You could call them the after people. They come alongside people after a crisis hits and provide high quality care and for as long as the after is needed. What is a grieving person likely to experience during the recoil? Well, intense feelings for one. Feelings of loneliness and guilt and anger. And these can be very, very very, very strong. And the psalmist dealt with some of this kind of thing, and I'm sorry, I should have probably looked a little more at the context of why the psalmist said this in Psalm 38. But I'd just like to have you enter into this with me and think, and let's read it responsively. I think it's time for you to get up, perhaps. Would you mind? And let's read it responsively. And this is not King James. I tried to look up what it was, and I don't really have it. But I'll let you start out, and I'll read the bold parts. Or maybe I should have done it the other way, because you could read the bold parts better, couldn't you? I am bowed down and brought very low. All day long I go about mourning.
My back is filled with searing pain. There is no health in my body.
I am feeble and utterly crushed. I groan in anguish of heart.
All my longings lie open before you, O Lord. My sighing is not hidden from you.
My heart pounds. My strength fails me. Even the light has gone from my eyes. I have become like a man who does not hear, whose mouth can offer no reply. Let's say the reference, Psalm 38, 6 to 11 and 14. You may sit down if you wish. Isn't it interesting? My friends and companions avoid me because of my wounds. My neighbors stay far away. Whose mouth can offer no reply. There are just a lot of things about this that can hit the care receiver and the caregiver as far as that's concerned. All my longings lie open before you, O Lord. My sighing is not hidden from you. And, you know, we need to know when to do it, I think, but in a lot of ways, it's all right. Let's just be all right with trusting Christian friends to know that we've got the sighing and the cryings and the longings. And let's be sure to treat our brothers and sisters with loving care as we sense how they're crushed in heart. So the shock is worn off, the floodgates are open, and the feelings come rushing out, and there's panic, and there's worry, and fear, and anger, and guilt, and relief, and emptiness, loneliness, and sadness. You know, in this time, people can feel very, very lonely, because now the things, you know, there's a hole, there's a great loss. The loved one is gone. And so, especially, can be this way for a couple, but it can happen in other ways when other family members go too. Sometimes guilt is powerful, and Satan comes to, well, maybe there's good reason too, but feelings of guilt are common. Some grieving blame themselves for somehow having caused or not prevented the death, and many deeply regret the words that they said or the attitudes they had while the person was still alive. And maybe sometimes people second guess the medical decisions that they made. And so that brings something to work through and a sense of guilt. And I'm going to take a few minutes to read to you from David Bogard's book again. He's entitled this chapter, Vain Regrets. You know, I read in chapter 3 how he was strengthened in the day of needing to make the decisions. And let's see, I thought it was chapter 4. Let's see if I can find it here. Yes, here it is. But in this chapter, I must speak of the most agonizing period of my life. It occurred an hour or more after I had discovered my wife on the floor. The mortician had come and gone. I was now alone in my home. Dimly, I began to realize the meaning of what had happened to me. I walked back and forth for a few minutes, but said to myself, You have some rugged days ahead of you. You'd better save your strength. And I retired to my bedroom, if not to sleep, at least to relax. Then it happened. The thought came to me that what has been written in my life with her had been written. And never in this life could I ever do anything to change it. Later there would come pleasant recollections for which I could be grateful. But just then I thought only of my failures and shortcomings in my life with her. This was focused mostly on the last months when she had been so handicapped with a painful leg. I remembered occasions when I had been less than fully gracious, patient, and considerate. She had made such a gallant effort to carry on with a smile, but I, who knew her so well, knew it was a deliberate attempt to make a good showing. I saw the lines in her face deepen as the weeks passed. Only on rare occasions she had given way to discouragement, though it took all her resolution not to yield more frequently. Although she had spoken appreciatively of my ministry to her, I had occasionally felt rebelliousness at the restrictions under which we had to live. How often I could have spoken words of encouragement, indicated my appreciation for her persistent courage, or had more sympathy when her courage momentarily failed. How often I could have spoken an extra word of endearment or taken her into my arms to comfort her, but sin entered in even here and spoiled everything, and now those damning recollections accused me. I could find justification for my failures, which mitigated my guilt, but as soon as these excuses came into my mind, I knew that they were cheap and unworthy. In that hour, there was only self-accusation and overwhelming regret that seemed to engulf me. A deep sense of guilt is one of life's most devastating experiences, especially when there's no possible way of undoing the past. I remember David's sorrow when he heard of his son's death. Oh, Absalom, would that I had died for thee! But I doubt whether there was a deep sense of personal guilt in his sorrow. The prodigal son said, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, but he could also arise and go back to his father. But I, conscious of my failures at the time when she needed added sympathy and devotion, could not ask her to forgive. I had to live with my guilt. I wept uncontrollably. Loud, gasping sobs that had their origin deep within. I knelt by my bed and spoke to her, asking for her forgiveness, hoping that across the divide that now separated us, she could perhaps hear me. Surely the intimate communication that had existed between us so long, so intimately, and so recently could not be broken off by the mere incident of death. Was that the action of a fool? Perhaps. I do not know. I was not guided at that moment by logic or theological accuracy. I only know that I longed to have her know my regret. I also know there was no response. Only silence. I turned to the Lord Jesus, who I believed was there in the beyond, and asked him, please, to tell her about my regrets. Whether that was a sane prayer, I do not know. When one's needs are great, one does not weigh the propriety of his prayers. I lived with all that self-condemnation for many days. It was submerged at times by the necessity of making decisions about many things, but when I was alone, it returned to me. I confided in a few friends who assured me that such regrets were quite customary in those who had lost loved ones. After all, you're human, they said. You should not blame yourself for such failures. Their attempts were kindly meant, but they didn't help me. I needed a more satisfactory answer. For many years, I have enjoyed an intimate relation with a friend of kindred spirit. He has lived for a dozen years without his lovely wife and has come to terms with life. I wrote him about my experience. His response, which came post-haste, showed me the way to peace. He reminded me that I, too, was a sinful human being, and that condition entered into all of life, even into the tender relations that exist between husband and wife. He advised me to take my regrets to the foot of the cross, confess them there, and believe that they were forgiven. Then came the sentence that has opened the way to peace for me. If you believe that you've been forgiven, then you must also forgive yourself. Yes. Now, that made sense. I do believe that all sins that are confessed are forgiven, those against God and against a dear one. If they are forgiven, God remembers them no more. If that is true, and this is the very heart of the gospel message, who am I to continue bearing the burden of guilt that God has forgiven and forgotten? So, although I still wish I could hear her say that she's forgiven me, something I'm certain she would do, I do find peace in the assurance that I am forgiven, and I'm also learning to forgive myself. However, forgiving oneself and forgetting are two different things. I am certain of the first, and yet I haven't achieved the second. Now I'm able to think of her as she was during all our years together, her unfailing loyalty to me, her gentle spirit, her sensitivity to all things beautiful, her awareness to the presence of God in nature, her artistic talent that she never was given a chance to develop fully, her deep concern for others, her patience with an impatient husband, her delicate sense of humor, her boundless appreciation of great music, her dedicated search for closeness to God, her patient courage during the last months, and so on and on and on. One thought was repeated over and over in the letters that flooded my home. She was a wonderful person. One young friend wrote, "She was a special gift of sunshine, laughter, and love. What a lucky man you were to have had her all these years." Thoughts such as these please me greatly, but I do not forget that heart-rending hour of self-condemnation. Well, I knew that I probably wouldn't get all the way through this outline. The next one would be anger as a deep feeling. And then there's the faith crisis. I think we'll just look at the outline here again. And if some of you would like to finish filling it out, it will be your opportunity here if I can find that. And then I will try to conclude with. It so happens that this is a week of assignments. I had the devotional last Sunday morning. I have this topic tonight, and Sunday I preach. If I've been loading this subject up, and if I happen to come back with something more, you think you can stand it? I'm not sure. It's not a statement of intention yet. It's a statement of, I know I didn't get done, and maybe it's where it ought to be left. I don't know if you've got all your blanks filled out, but if you can find the blanks and want to fill it out, you may. We didn't get to the point about platitudes. Let's be careful about what are some of the things that you think of that we can say that are hurtful? Well-intentioned, maybe, but, well, I don't think anybody would aim to be hurtful at a time of grief. Is anybody, yes?
How about, I know how you feel, because we don't.
I think that's probably one of the most common. Let's see here. While we get on to that one, is there any others? Yes, David. Yes, you know, for the one that's grieving, that probably is not what they're usually thinking, right? I mean, if they feel that way, let's let them say it. Once again, it's more of a, I'm here with you because I care. I'm here to assure you of my prayers. Would you like to have some help if my boys had come over and mow the yard? That's a better one than let me know if I can do. We can do something for you. That kind of puts the weight back on them. And so if we can think of something specific, probably that's then we can open our mouths. If we can't, then maybe we just need to do some listening until we figure it out. But all the reading that I've done, the theme that keeps coming through is to be accepting of how people are feeling and to be slow to offer a lot of preachy things. And, you know, I mean, maybe there's the exception of the son who's wayward and dad is dead now. And maybe you challenge that man with a young man with a heart of love to think about where dad is and how he can follow his dad. But generally speaking, let's learn to identify, to enter in to the people, to reflect back to them what they're feeling and saying, and not trying to correct them and say, no, you're living in self in denial, or no, you're just being angry at God, and whatever they're trusting you to say. Is there something else that you want to say on that before we close? Well, I think I'm just going to have to come back to the beginning and say that as we experience life and as we come to the things that are deeply disappointing, by the way, I found it interesting that Joseph Bailey says that the deepest sorrow comes from losing a child, and he lost three. And this man says that the greatest terror is to lose a spouse, which is right out of their lives. And I'm not here to say that I can say anything better than those probably top the list. And don't know that I need to break a tie or anything like that. There's another thing, that comment that I read that I'm just sort of randomly thinking of here, that it was said that don't tell people I don't know what to say. You know, that's at least a statement of honesty, and it's not saying something that causes them to weep. And so it's certainly not maybe as strong a statement as I want to assure you of my prayers, or I'm here to care, or other statements like that, statements of sympathy and acceptance. Those are the statements that I think we can focus on, and perhaps we don't need to say, I don't know what to say, and yet on the other hand, I'm not quite so sure that that's such a bad one either, because if that's the thing that you can think to say, it's honest, and it might have some value. I'm sure that if I come back to this, there will be some more things that and experiences that I'd like to cover. But if not, let's just go through the school of life. Let's commit ourselves to being caring people, sensitive to each other, building each other up, and God helping us, we can move beyond those beginning stages of denial and anger and guilt and other things that may have their rightful place as we process the losses of life. So I leave you with the thought that Jesus is our great comforter, and just pray that God will lead us from here. Brother Lowell.